Revelation 17, what the scriptures call the doom of Babylon. And as you turn there, I'd like to, just in a small way, give you an idea of what I'm talking about. When we look at the 17th chapter and we look at the unity of this world that Satan has planned all along and is accomplishing, and I'll start reading with you and introduce the characters, and then we'll describe it a little bit more. Revelation 17, the first verse. "And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me." And that's talking about what we saw in the 16th chapter many months ago when we looked through those bowls of wrath and how coming out of the temple of heaven, these angels would come and pour them out. And as the censers or the bowls of judgment would be poured out, they would explode onto the earth, and we saw those, and that was a magnificent outpouring of God's character as it's revealed in his judgments. But one of those seven angels came and spoke with me, that's John the Apostle, saying, "Come here, and I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot," character number one, the great harlot, "who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality." So immediately, you know, we're getting into metaphoric and symbolic reference, great harlot, drunk with wine of immorality in that. And so there's a reason the Lord doesn't want to say this is and put a name with it. And I think that's something we need to realize when we look at Scripture, that God, who knows all things, who knows us down to our fingerprints, as we saw a couple weeks ago, he could have put down anything he wanted here, but he used a metaphoric or a symbolic reference for two reasons, and it's something we need to consider. Number one, if he'd have put a name in, people would have been claiming to be that person all throughout history. If he would have said, "This is Nero," then everybody would have been Nero. You know what I mean? It's just the idea of delusions of grandeur and a complex, and so he puts it in a prophetic, mysterious way for those who really study to perceive his plan, but to keep the crazies from claiming to be that. Secondly, the second reason he does that is that God in his plan makes the scriptures only discernible, like parables, to those who seek him and seek his mind. So therefore, when we come to allusions like in the 17th chapter, it's not the best thing to put and plug in names. As I've told you before, I have a shelf full of commentaries on the book of Revelation. I can date almost all of them, because by the time we get to any of these passages, they put someone's name in there. I remember when one notable preacher said that Christ was coming back in 1976. I sat there. I heard the sermon. And I'll tell you what, his records, this was about 74, were selling like hotcakes. At New Year's Eve of 75, the sales had really gone down. Because 76 came, as you know, and went, and Christ did not come. And that's one of the difficulties we have with overemphasizing prophetic literature and putting names in the places. So here's the first cast member who is symbolic, and we're going to see, because the Lord always gives you enough so you know what he's talking about. So there's a great harlot. Verse 2 says that people on the earth are getting drunk with the immorality. Verse 3, "And he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman." Oh, this is the great harlot. A woman now. It's a woman, a great harlot. Okay, there's this woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman didn't have the seven heads and ten horns. The beast did, and she's sitting on this beast. So she's being carried around. And this woman is in the wilderness. And the wilderness, always in biblical literature, speaks of the abode of the spirits. And that's why Christ met Satan in the wilderness, right? And it's the whole idea where they sent the scapegoat. It's the realm, a void of the protection normally offered, and you're out there in difficult times. So this woman is out in this spiritual wilderness, a place of demons. She's sitting on this scarlet monster, has blasphemous names written all around, and seven heads and ten horns. So if you're starting to think, we have, you know, a woman, we have a beast, we have seven heads, and we have ten horns. And so there are a lot of characters here. So we get to verse 4, and it says, "And the woman." Now, here she is again, this harlot in verse 1 is a woman, verse 3. Verse 4, "This woman is clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones." She's obviously wealthy or opulent or something, and pearls. Remember, pearls were the most valuable. All the ancient, they didn't think as much of diamonds as we do. They thought of pearls, and that's why the Lord said a pearl of great price. And to them, that was, rubies and pearls were the big things, and to us, diamonds and other things. But to them, so what he's saying is this gal is the pinnacle of wealth. She has pearls, and in her hands, a gold cup, another sign of wealth, that your common drinking vessel will be made of gold, full of abominations. That's an interesting word. Beduglima is an idea of idolatry. So there's something with this harlot woman who is sitting on this beast who's out in the wilderness, who is richly clothed. She has something to do with idolatry, because that's one of the keys we're going to see as we come back through this. And on her forehead, a name was written. And I don't know if you've caught this when I read the invocationary literature, that the forehead is a sign of the character. That's why the 666 folks that get the forehead number on their hand, it's speaking of someone who is having and has received the character of Satan. And this woman has this character. And here it is written. Their name is their character. It's a mystery. And a mystery means you don't fully understand it. And it's Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Now, right off, there have been people ever since the Reformation that have said this is obviously the Roman Catholic Church. The only problem with that is that if this is the Roman Catholic Church, then that means that there wasn't ever a problem before the Roman Catholic Church came along. And so that's what one of the dangers is of immediately putting a name in there, because it says that Babylon the Great, and Babylon really predates the Roman Church, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. Now, is this talking about somebody that has a house of ill repute going on? It's metaphoric. It can't be sexually. This is talking spiritually. We're talking about a woman that's involved with idolatry. And so she is the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Well, verse 6, so I saw the woman. Here she is again. She's the main character of this chapter. Drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. Now that's significant. Two groups. They're both God's people, but the saints are the Old Testament, and the witnesses of Jesus are the New Testament. We're all saints, but he's trying to differentiate. And so those who are witnesses of Jesus, the Old Testament, they didn't even know his name. So they weren't witnesses of Jesus. They were saints of God looking forward to the promised one. They didn't know his name yet, except it would be God with us. And here, verse 6 says that this woman was drunk with the blood. In other words, she has been involved in the martyrdom of both Old Testament and New Testament followers of Jesus Christ. So obviously it has to be bigger than the Roman Church, which I have half my commentaries immediately say this is Catholicism. So here's this woman drunk with the blood of both Old and New Testament saints. And when I saw her, I wondered greatly. You see, John was starting to see, and God was revealing to him something that without this revelation we wouldn't have known, that there really is a conspiracy. Although I don't really think it's the Illuminati, and I don't think it's the Masons, and I don't think it's the Rothschilds, and I don't think it's the International Economic Council of the G7 or the G9, or, you know what I mean? It's much bigger than that, because it's Satan's conspiracy. And basically what we see here is that this woman is involved somehow with all of the persecution that has gone on from the Old Testament times all the way through into our present time. It spans the whole time period. And that's why John wondered greatly, because, by the way, we're in the 17th chapter, and he's looking at all the persecution, all the beheading, and all this, and all of a sudden God reveals to him who has been behind this all this time. Verse 7, and the angel said to me, why do you wonder? I will tell you the mystery of the woman. Here she is again. You know she's mentioned all the way through. And of the beast. There's the beast again. The beast was up there in verse 3, a scarlet beast, and now here's the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. And there they are again. The cast keeps reappearing on the stage. So here's the explanation. And that's why it's most important to interpret Scripture with Scripture. And before you get all the code books and all the prophecy books and, you know, stack up who they think that, you know, it's Russia here and that and there, the first and most important thing is to get the entire biblical perspective before you fit in all of man's speculations. And that's why the best library you need to study the Bible is the Bible. And if we spent less time getting everybody's opinion and more time really going back and forth, because the book of Revelation is the most cross-referenced book in the Bible. There are hundreds of allusions and quotes from the Old Testament in the book of Revelation. And that's why it's so important. Well, the beast you saw, he's going to start now getting the picture. The beast you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss. That's interesting to think about, especially since God says it's appointed unto men once to die, and after that to judgment. Because either God is going to let some human being unregenerate who was and who is and is coming back out of the abyss and break all the rules, because some people call this Nero Re Davidis, which means Nero comes back to life, and other people think it's Judas, and some people think it's David Koresh. You know, that's the new one running around the prophetic circles, you know, because everybody saw him burn up on TV, didn't we? And if he came back, it would really get everybody. So, but this beast, which was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss, that's the pit. That's where Satan's minions are held, and that's where Satan's going to be put and held in. And those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. That's one of the dear verses of this chapter. It talks about the fact of our security, that those who are in the book of life were written in there from the foundation of the world, and God has always been in charge of salvation. When they see the beast that he was and is not and will come. Now, you notice this is very much like the title of God, who is, who was, and who is to come, right? And so that's something that gives us a little glimmer when we think about who this is, because it's someone that is emulating or trying to counterfeit God. And so this beast obviously is very much tied with Satan and most likely is an incarnation of Satan. Verse 9, and this is the mind which has wisdom. And here's more secrets. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And immediately, I mean, people stop right there and they go, ah, what's the only city of the world that's known as the city on seven hills? Rome. So obviously it's Roman Catholic Church. But the only problem is you have to keep reading. And they are seven kings. Oh. Seven mountains aren't seven mountains. Seven mountains are a figure of seven kings, because mountains in the Bible speaks of kingdoms. And when we're in the book of Daniel, Daniel sees a stone not cut with human hands, which is Jesus Christ, who comes and crushes the Antichrist government, and that stone grows into a mountain, which is the kingdom. And so in the Bible, mountains are kings and their kingdoms, not seven, the Palatine and the Equestrian and all the other hills of Rome. And so that's the difficulty that you have to read and be careful. But the seven heads are the seven mountains on which the woman sits. And these are seven kings, verse 10. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. Now we're starting to get into the, you know, jumbo mumbo stuff, like what are we talking about here? And verse 11 says, and the beast which was and is not, and himself is also an eighth, is one of the seven. And he goes to destruction. Now it sounds like what my high school chemistry teacher used to give us, these questions that used to take hours to figure out. If you read them long enough and made a chart, you could finally figure it out, because we're starting to get into that realm of, this guy is one of the eight, but he's also one of the seven. It sounds like, you know, it's Michael Jordan, who you don't know if he's basketball or baseball. You know what I mean? He's crossing over. So here we go. And he'll remain a little while. And verse 12 says, and the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, who have not yet received a kingdom, but when they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. And so these guys are standing in the wings, and they're waiting to come into power with this beast, which is, which was, and which is to come out of the abyss, this fella. And these have one purpose, verse 13, and they give their power and their authority to the beast. In other words, they're sold out, they're pawns. They have one purpose, and that's supporting this beast. Verse 14, these will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are the called and the chosen and the faithful. That's us. We're the called, we're the chosen, and we're the faithful. And that's neat. We're on the winning side. That's kind of nice. I mean, every time there's an athletic contest, someone wins and someone loses. And you can't be on both sides and be a real fan. And every time there's a war, there are good people on both sides. And every time that there's any type of deciding event, there are people that are winners and people that are losers. And all of us are, at times, on the losing end of many things. This fleet layoff, there are people at the losing end of that. Our national politics are winners and losers, and sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But verse 14 tells us that though athletically you might be sometimes picking winners and sometimes losers, and though politically you might be winning and losing, and though in all realms of life we sometimes come out on the winning and losing side, that when you are part of the called and part of the chosen and part of the faithful, you have gotten on the team that always wins. And that's just a thrilling thought in the 14th verse, that the Lamb, you know, and it doesn't say the lion. It's talking about Christ as the Redeemer. Lion is him as conqueror. Lamb is him as Redeemer. And these will wage war against the Lamb, against the Redeemer. All these hosts of Satan, all these rulers, and the 7 and the 10 and the 8 and the 1 and all these, this gang, unite against the Lamb, against the Redeemer. Verse 15, and he said to me, now we're getting back to this, one of the seven angels from chapter 16 that's talking to John, and he said to me, the waters which you saw, the waters. Why, that's back in verse 1. This woman is sitting on many waters. See, the Bible always explains itself. The waters which you saw in verse 1, where the harlot sits, remember back in verse 1, are the peoples and the multitudes and the nations and the tongues. It's the world. So this woman is kind of sitting astride the world. Finally, the dream of the ages to really rule the world. Everybody's wanted to do that. Napoleon wanted to do it. He didn't make it. I'm sure that the Caesars wanted to do it. They didn't make it. There have always been rulers. Hitler thought he was going to do it with the Axis powers, with Germany, Italy, and Japan. They thought, you know, with that Eastern connection, they would rule the world. And maybe they might have if they hadn't made a few missteps in the oil fields and a few other things they did wrong that actually led to their defeat. But finally, there is a world rulership coming. And it says here that this woman is sitting on the peoples and the multitudes and the nations and the tongues. So there's a global seeming rulership going on here. And it says in verse 16 that the 10 horns, there they are again, they showed up again, which you saw, and the beast, there he is again, these will hate the harlot. Oh, now we're having a little infighting here. And this group of leaders, these powerful world leaders, are turning on this powerful world leader. The one, harlot, gets turned on by all of these 10 horns and the beast. And these will hate the harlot, and they will make her desolate, verse 16 says, and naked, and they will eat her flesh, and they will burn her up with fire. Now, again, we're in the symbolic, metaphoric. We're not talking about cannibalism here. We're talking about some type of a global organization that is set up and used, and all of a sudden, the real power behind this harlot comes forward and topples her and takes over her domain. And that's basically what happens. And it says in verse 17, for God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. And then here's one more cryptic statement. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Whole chapter in 10 minutes. Let me talk to you about something. I brought one of my cards. I didn't bring my good one. I should have brought, I got a gold card in the mail a while back. And you know, it's interesting. If you get these credit cards and never use them, they keep raising the credit limits because you never are late. And I have one that they mailed me when we got married. I told Bonnie this, and with a $500 credit limit. And I don't believe we've ever used it. It's from some little town in New York, Empire Telecom Federal Credit Union. I don't think we've ever used the card. And I think when I looked at the last statement, it's up to $7,500 credit limit. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what good it does them to keep upping that, whether it helps their stock or their earnings potential, but credit cards are an interesting thing because when you travel around the world with a credit card, and those of you that travel, and we have businessmen here that travel internationally all the time and can attest to this, I have pulled out my credit card in all different corners of the world and passed it over. I mean, on every continent except Antarctica. And I've gone there and bought things and handed that credit card in, and they swipe it through that machine, and it goes, and out comes my name. And out comes information about me from that little stripe that's on that card, that little magnetic strip that, remember, you're not supposed to do bad things to, it'll ruin it. And if it gets worn too much, they wipe it off and they keep running it through that machine. And somehow that card is taken, and when it's run through that machine reads it and instantaneously sets off a signal that goes through the telephone lines to some computer center. And in that computer center, those 12 digits, I think 12, 4, 4, and 4, 12 numbers are on the credit card because, you know, three sets of four numbers. Somehow it goes in there into that bank and it checks out those numbers and it comes right back. Usually it's a very short time, and they know all about me. And they're getting more sophisticated. I was recently in an establishment where it went through like that, and it not only printed my name, but it printed my address on that statement, on that little card. And it knew 401 Davisville Road. Some of my credit cards are at 6356, and some are at 401. And it knew which card I had. And it knew where the bill went. Look back at chapter 17, because I want you to think about this in verse 1. Because what we're looking at here is, we're looking at one facet of Satan's plan, and I want to work with you through this and kind of give you the big picture. That's why I did the whole chapter, because chapter 17 of Revelation describes the doom of Babylon, and this seems to be a symbol of world religion. That's the only thing that fits all this. Only world religion encompasses every kingdom and tribe and tongue and nation. That's one thing everybody on the planet has in common. Everybody is religious. Now, we're all different religious natures, you know, and there are people that are worshiping rocks and people that are worshiping worms and people that are worshiping idols and people that are worshiping, you know, religious stuff in a Christian connotation, but everybody's religious. That's one thing that all the world has in common. They worship something. And so it looks like chapter 17 is talking about the global religious world system. And so what we see here is basically what would be the counterfeit church that Satan founded at Eden and has worked ceaselessly to bring to pass. And finally it happens. Now, personally, I believe the reason that he makes it and finally has a global church is because of what happened earlier, and that is that the true church got taken out. Because, you know, we are the impediment to what Satan plans. We are an impediment to his progress toward global unity. Because every time he makes a step, we start going, wait a minute, the Bible doesn't say that. Wait a minute, you know, and we mess up the vibes because we're so exclusive. But I believe that the reason that this happens is because the church is gone, and we'll talk about that later. But Satan has had as his ultimate goals a threefold unity on his planet. Number one, he wanted to have a worldwide religious unity. Now let me show you what he's working at. Look back at chapter 13 of Revelation. You can see this right in the text, because Satan, in chapter 13 and verse 8, has found someone that people will worship globally instead of Jesus Christ. Now the whole world can't agree right now on who to worship. Some people are worshiping Gaia, Mother Earth Goddess, and some people are worshiping Muhammad, and some people are worshiping Moroni and all of his stuff and Mormonism, and other people are worshiping departed spirits, and some people, you know what I mean? It's kind of fragmented. But look at 13:8. It says, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him. This beast, this incarnation of Satan. Remember, Satan always counterfeits. How did God come down and do such a masterful job of redemption? He came down and became human flesh. And so Satan, that's a great idea, comes down and incarnates in this beast. He possesses, or maybe even more than possession, but whatever, this beast is the Satan man on the earth. And it says, all who dwell on the earth will worship him. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. There's that idea of our security. Chapter 11, verse 2 has a similar. It says and leave it out in the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it's been given to the nations, and they will tread it underfoot, the holy city, for 42 months. In other words, this idea that there's going to be this Gentile incursion into the temple area, and that's very much what the beast is involved in. In chapter 11, the two witnesses were confronting him for preparing for this false worship. It's a little bit more full-blown if you look at chapter 14 now, across the page to verse 9. It says, and another angel, a third one, followed them and said, if anyone worships the beast and his image, so not only is he there, but he's also had this image of himself made, and receive this mark, that's an identifying thing, on their forehead or on their hand to show that they're part of it, then they're going to get the wrath of God. So this fella, this beast, is number one, worshipped. Now, look at 13:3, chapter 13, verse 3. He's not only worshipped, he's loved. And it says, I saw one of the heads as if it had been slain in a fatal wound, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. I mean, this guy has a real following. This fella, this incarnation, or whatever he is, this satanic, global, religious ruler and leader, is worshipped, and he's not just worshipped, he's admired. It says the whole world, verse 3, follows after him. He's just kind of like one of those people. I don't know if you've ever seen someone that really has charisma, but they walk by and you just kind of go, wow. You know, there's some people, they're just so confident, and they're just so neat that people just want to be like them. They want to follow them. That's how dads are to their sons as they're growing up, and that's how moms are to their daughters, and that's how godly people ought to be in the church. But this fella far goes beyond that, and he becomes someone everyone wants to be like, and they admire him. In verse 8, he's honored. Not only is he worshipped, but he's honored because it said in verse 8 of chapter 13 that they worship him, and that's really, that idea is, not only is it a religious worship, but they're honoring him with their attention. They're focusing on him. He is very confidently followed. Look at verse 4 of chapter 13. It says, and they worship the dragon. That's his power behind him. The dragon is Satan, because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, now listen to this confidence. Who is like the beast? Nobody can beat him. I mean, he is the winner. You see that? They're very confident. And the whole world is looking for someone like that right now. And that's why I think it's very significant when you think about your credit cards and when you think about the climate of our world, that we are getting very close to the point where we can have a global religious unity. As I said this morning, the Boston Globe said that these three religious figures, the pagan spirit Native American guy and the Buddhist Eastern religion guy and the Western Christianity guy, they all had their arms around each other and said, boy, we found out we really all believe the same thing. Isn't it wonderful? We all have a wonderful future ahead of us. And that's what the beast is working on. His first goal is this idea of a worldwide religious unity. So right away, the book of Revelation tells us in chapter 17 that there is a constant tension between the two. And let me remind you what I'm talking about. God has a true church. So if God has a true church, Satan has a false church. And God's true church is exclusive. So what would Satan's true church be? It would be ecumenical. Ecumenical means everybody's welcome. I mean, look at God. He limits the people that can go to heaven, but we won't. You can all come to our heaven. The true church is a bride. The false church in chapter 17, what is it characterized as? A harlot. What's a bride? Loyal to one. What's a harlot? Loyal to anyone. See the difference? Satan's counterfeit. Similar, but with a little twist his way. God, as I said, is exclusive, and Satan is ecumenical. God says one way, Satan says many ways. I mean, come through any church or chapel or synagogue or cult or temple you want. All roads lead to me. God has a heavenly destination. Satan says, heaven. Heaven can wait. Earth. You notice what in our conscious generation, our time that all of us have experienced in the last few years, have you noticed the subtle shift toward the earth? Hey, we're changing everything. We have to have an earth-friendly car and an earth-friendly, you go shopping and you look and at garbage bags, you know, this is earth-friendly. And toilet bowl cleaner, earth-friendly. And I was looking the other day in the bathroom at the Glade spray, and it says, this is beneficial for the ecology. And I thought, is that helping the ecology? You know, what? Every product has that idea. The earth. You see, Satan is saying, don't worry about heaven. Heaven can wait. Earth. You see how the cults play into this? What's the highest desire of a Jehovah's Witness? Why, to be on the earth. Who wants to go to heaven? Be on the earth. What are the Mormons? They want to repopulate the earth. What do the Muslims want? They want to be in paradise. They want to be on earth. It's the earth, and that's it's playing right in what Satan's orchestrating. God's capital is Jerusalem. Satan's capital is Babylon. God says the city of peace. Satan offers the city Babylon. You know what Babel means? It means confusion. So the world is headed toward this religious ecumenical confusion. God's kingdom is spiritual. Satan's kingdom is fleshly. God's kingdom is internal. He says, what you get from me is internal. What Satan offers is external. He offers external unity. He offers external religiosity. God offers internal peace and internal transformation. They're similar, but they're diametrically opposed. God says, everything came from nothing. I created it. Satan says, everything came from something and it evolved. You see what is world religion? I mean, it's everywhere. They say evolution isn't a religion. It's the religion of the world. It's the idea that we're spiraling upward. We'll all be in Star Wars. We can all have our arm cut off and get a new one. We can all die and come back and be great. And just that idea permeates our society, and that's Satan's conspiracy. God teaches monotheism, that he is the one and only God. Satan teaches polytheism. You believe in that God? Fine. It's just a different name of the same God, and we're all happy. God talks about heaven ruling. Satan talks about astrology, the stars rule. God says, worship me in spirit. Satan says, no, you got to have something concrete to worship. So all world religions have some type of idolatrous connection, except Christianity. True Christianity has no idols. They have no images. They have no need for something to hold on to and something concrete, because we worship God in the spirit. Every other religion in the world worships their God in the flesh. And they have some, either Mecca has the big black stone, or Buddhists have the big fat bronze Buddha, or the Hindus have the countless gods, but everyone has attached their worship to something, except true spiritual worship to God. God says he's divine, and he alone is divine. Satan says, no, you can be a god too. Remember what he said to Eve? He says, you can be a god too. Don't listen to God. He's too limiting. Expand your horizons. That's the temptation of Genesis 3. God says faith. Satan says intellectualism, that you get knowledge, and if you know more, and it's the whole Gnostic idea that you get this knowledge and you'll get the inside track. God says spirit worship. Satan says religious ritual. So that's Satan's first desire, to have a worldwide global church. Secondly, he has a desire to have a worldwide political unity. And that's why if you go back to chapter 17, you notice that it's seven heads. Seven in the Bible always talks about a completion. There are 7 days in the week, right? It's the idea. Even music, there's seven notes, and then the eighth one. It's seven plus one. It starts, and it's just this upward spiral of perfection. And so what we see here is that God says that in this last time that this beast is sitting with the seven heads. That's talking about a complete final political or ruling power. And Satan has always had a desire to have political unity. It says in Revelation 13 and verse 16, it says, and he causes all the small and great, the rich and poor, and the free and the slaves to be given a mark on their right hand. Now, anybody that can cause you to be tattooed on your head and hand has got to be in control. And finally, this world is going to get to the place where there is political unity, where there is one organization or one person or one group calling all the shots. Now, we can speculate, and I think what it looks like is here that there are 10 political divisions. It looks like these 10 rulers that are coming, it's like there's one global ruler, and he's divided the earth into 10 zones. Now, some people, they say it's to revive Europe. That's great. It could be, but I mean, why not include everybody else? And it looks like the 10 could be a little bit wider than just Western society, which we always center on. But whatever it is, and if God wanted us to know exactly that which 10 nations are in this organization, he could have named them, but he doesn't. So, you know, dogmatism on unrevealed things doesn't really help the situation. But what we see is there is a political unity. The seven heads speaks of this religious entity that's also a political entity that chapter 13 says they can cause everybody on the planet to get marked. Now, I know people that, I mean, you can't make them do anything. I mean, people resist safety inspection stickers. I mean, can you imagine going in and getting tattooed? And in a very prominent place, or whatever it is, it might not be a tattoo, it might be an implant of a chip, but I mean, that's a serious thing, and so there's kind of total rule. And finally, it says, look at verse 17, not only is it religious and political, but here's the linchpin, and that's where my credit card comes in. Look at 17 of chapter 13. Revelation 13, 17 says this, and he provides, this global ruler, the beast, provides that no one should be able to buy or sell except the one who has the mark. And really, this is the linchpin. I mean, you can be a religious leader and people say, I don't care about your religion. You can be a political leader and people can say, I don't talk about politics. But you know the one thing that all of us can't get along without? You can't get along without money in a global economy and in a urban setting. Now, some of you have nice farms and nice gardens and all, but you go to where more than 60% of all the people in the world live, into urban areas, and you know what? They truck everything in, they truck everything out. They pipe everything in, they pipe everything out. Los Angeles is one of the most marvelous engineering feats in the world. Los Angeles has all their water brought in, all their food brought in, all of their needs brought in, and everything they don't want taken out. There's not enough to feed 15 million people in Southern California unless that steady stream of trucks that you heard about after the earthquake, those 146,000 a day that go through that city and do what they do and drop off their loads, unless they do that every day, that city will starve. What the beast has in verse 17 is he has what everyone has dreamed of. A lot of people want to be the religious ruler. A lot of people want to be the political ruler, but only one achieves all three because he is the economic, the commercial, the business, the monetary dictator of the world. That was never possible in the past. You know why? Some people traded in silver coins. Some people traded in gold coins. Some people had rupees. Some people had D-marks. Some people had this. Some people had that. But now we've come to a global economy. We've come to finally where you can take your card, and it's fun to do this. You can put your credit card in, put it through, punch the buttons at an ATM in France, and get your money in francs right out of your checking account at Fleet. That's a global economy. You can call and order something from overseas and instantly have it paid for and accounted for, and it goes through that gigantic clearinghouse of the world that's in New York City, where all the financial transactions are all balanced. Because right now America is the clearinghouse of the world financially. And what this beast gets is the final piece you need to rule the world. And that is the economic stranglehold on everyone. And you can't buy and you can't sell without him. And if you can't buy and if you can't sell without him, you can't live. If you want to read an interesting book on it, Larry Burkett wrote a book, I think it's the one called The Illuminati, which talks about this fellow that's running around trying to buy gas, trying to get to where all the Christians are, and every time he goes to a gas station and sticks his card in, because you don't have money anymore, you go to those kind you swipe your card through, and you swipe your card through it, and it goes, why? Because he's known as a Christian, and every time he uses that card, they close down the gas pumps. You say, it's an interesting book. Well, we were just driving across from California to Arizona, and I put my card through, and it went, and it didn't say Christian. It just said, you know, I don't know if I had something wrong in the stripe or something, but I couldn't buy gas. And I had to go in and actually use money. But what are you going to do when there's no money to use, when we're in a cashless society? So that's what this chapter is about. In this specific chapter, let's go back to chapter 17 before we close, and I want to give you some good stuff, not just the bad stuff. But what we see in chapter 17 is the destruction of the worldwide religious entity, which is Babylon. Because this woman that's sitting on the water is the culmination of all of Satan's ideas of pantheism, polytheism, idolatry, humanism, and evolution. It's a global church. It encompasses his plan from the Garden of Eden of having man exalted, man worship, man as a god, having God out of the picture, explaining everything by way of evolutionary thought and a hypothesis that man can spiral upward, and so people buy that, so there's a global church. And so Satan's plan comes into pass. He has this beast, this scarlet beast with the 7 heads and 10 horns, that is leading the religious system, so the political leaders, the harlots, the religious system, and this beast is the political system with the 7 heads and 10 horns. The religion is following onto the political, and so Satan has encompassed both, and he gets it together when he gets the economic in there, and so basically we finally have the plan that Satan has always had to have world rulership. Now, Satan's key has always been to be a counterfeit. And I did a little study this week, and I'll just read this to you because we have to fly along here. But Satan has always counterfeited Christ. Jesus Christ came down from heaven. We all know that. However, Satan comes up from the abyss. You see, he comes too, to the earth. Jesus Christ came in the Father's name. Satan comes in his own name. Remember, the beast comes in his own name, the name of the dragon. Christ's nature is he is the Holy One. He embodies truth. He's the Redeemer. He's the mystery of godliness. He's the Son of God. Satan comes, it says in 2 Thessalonians, as the lawless one. It says in 2 Thessalonians again that he embodies the lie. Daniel says he comes as the destroyer. He comes as the mystery of lawlessness. Christ was the mystery of godliness. And he is the son of perdition of the dragon, and Christ is the son of God, of the Father. You see, he parallels right down. Satan parallels not equality, but he parallels everything that Christ did because he comes as the anti-Christ. Anti can mean two things, against or instead of. Satan, up until the tribulation, is always against. At the tribulation hour, he's instead of. If you can't beat him, you join him. And instead of being against Christ, he just says, I am Christ. Instead of being against Christians, he said, worship me. And he tells people, you don't need this distant Christ in heaven. You've got me on earth. And he starts doing his signs and wonders. Well, just to close, I just want to show you this as a ray of hope in the midst of all this awful stuff coming. I want to show you, starting in verse 8 of chapter 17, who we are. Because in the midst of all this, and next week we'll actually divide up this chapter into its 3 parts, and I want to show you the keys and all the important things before we slip into chapter 18. But look at verse 8 just before we go. It says, the beast which you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss, this satanic leader, will go to destruction, and listen, and those who dwell on the earth will wonder, and here's the good part, whose name has not been written in the book of life. And to close, I just want to share what our hope is as those who believe in Christ, because we study for a long time the book of life, but I want to show you in the book of Revelation how wonderful it is to be in the book of life, because it says right here in 17:8 that we who are in the book of life are the ones who were known before the foundation of the world. We're the before the world known ones. We're so important to God. It says in verse 8, that he knew us from the foundation of the world. Have you ever gotten a kind of a late invitation to something? I mean, people have already planned the party, and they've already had everything set up, and then at the last minute they call you and they go, would you like to come too? And you know how that makes you feel? It's nice to be remembered, but it's not very nice that they didn't think of me until the very end, right? We've all felt that, you know? It's kind of a slip. People go, you know what we mean. We meant to invite you. We were going to invite you. We didn't mail your invitation. They do that. And you kind of feel slighted. You feel, you know, small. You know what God says? You and I are not last-minute thoughts to him. It's not like at the very end he goes, oh, yeah, do you want to come? Do you want to go to heaven? Yeah. I need a couple more. How about you two? and it's not like that. It's all planned out. Verse 8 says, and it was repeated, I read to you 13:8, it says, these are the ones whose name were written from the foundation of the world. Isn't that exciting? We're the before known ones. We were known before anything else was here. Before there was any Garden of Eden. Before there was any thought of all that transpired. God had already chosen the before known ones. That's an interesting thought. Look at 21:27. Not only are we the before known ones, but look at Revelation 21:27. It says, "And nothing unclean and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." That's an interesting thought, because only those who are blood-bought ones, not only the before-known ones, not just the ones that God knew from eternity past, but those that he knew from eternity past and that he bought with the blood of Christ. It's a very special group. They were known before, and they were bought with the blood. The third one is, look at chapter 20, verse 15. The third aspect of us as believers in Christ, our hope is, we're not just the before-known ones and the blood-bought ones, but we're also the new-born ones. We have been born again. Chapter 20, verse 15 says this, "And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life," the book of life. How do you get in the book of life? You have to be born again. We're the ones who've been born again. And people that have never been born again into life, it says in verse 15, are cast into the lake of fire. You know what that is? That's the second death. If you're not a before-known one, if you're not a blood-bought one, if you're not a born-again one, you're not in this book. The fourth aspect, and this is out of the book of Revelation, look at Luke chapter 10, verse 20. Because the book of life is talked outside of the book of Revelation. Luke 10, 20, I want to read to you this 20th verse, because we are also to be the happy ones. And that's why we have to make a choice in life. That's why I read what I read to you. Even though everything around us is falling apart or seemingly looking like it's all coming together for the end, look what it says in Luke 10, 20. It says, "Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are recorded in heaven." Rejoice. A constant source of blessing to us should be that our names are on the register in heaven, that we are expected and honored guests of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He's expecting us. He's anticipating our coming to him. I can't imagine Christians being down in the mouth. You know, every time I get all kind of mopey and discouraged, my wife goes, you know how wives can do, she goes, "Rejoice in the Lord always." You know, again. She reminds me, she says, "Don't you remember what you're preaching? Aren't you listening to yourself preach?" And she reminds me that are you downhearted? No. Why? Because our names are written in heaven. And even if our names are off the roll of the retirement plan of our company, and even if our names are not on the cut of the first draft for the athletic team, and even if you didn't make it as Miss Whoever in some beauty pageant, guess what? No one can ever get you out of the book in heaven, because it's written in the blood of the Lamb. And that is supposed to be a source of great rejoicing in our hearts. Here's another one. Isaiah 4 and verse 3. Oh, you didn't know it was in the Old Testament. Yeah, it's in the Old Testament. This is an encompassing idea, this book that God is writing. It's all the way through the Bible. In Isaiah, that's in the Old Testament, chapter 4 and verse 3 says this, "And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem." You see, God is in the business of recording who is a winner and who is going to have life. But this verse says that those people who have life, who are in this book, who are in God's record, not only did he know them from the eternity past, not only did he buy them with the blood of Christ, not only are they born again and happy, but Isaiah 4 verse 3 says what I was mentioning this morning, they are holy. Look what it says. It says, they will be called holy. Holy. You know who's going to be in the book of life? Blood-bought, born-again, happy, holy people. It's kind of an interesting thought. We should be excited about that. Now, look at Philippians. Let's do Philippians and then Revelation. Back to the New Testament. Don't get lost. We're hurrying. Philippians chapter 4, verse 3. Philippians 4, 3. It says this, "Indeed, my true comrade, I ask you also to help those women who have shared in my struggle for the cause of the gospel, together with Clement also and the rest of his fellow workers, whose names are in the book of life." Do you know what people in the book of life are characterized by? They are people who are joyfully serving. You know what Paul calls them? He says, "with my fellow workers." He says, my fellow workers are people who are in the book of life. Now, it doesn't mean that his fellow workers because their fellow workers are in the book of life, he's saying that people that are in the book of life are joyful, they're born again, they're blood-bought, and you know what? They're happy to serve God. I think there's something we need to think about. God says the people that spend eternity with me are people that are holy, people that are happy, people that are serving me, people that have been washed by the blood of Christ, and people that God's known from eternity past. He doesn't say anything about church membership, doesn't say anything about, you know, all the stuff we put stock in. He's talking about our character. And on the inside, we're joyful. On the inside, we're wanting to serve God. On the inside, we know we've been washed clean. Here's another one. Revelation 3:5. I don't want to get you lost going back to Daniel. It says it in two places, but Revelation 3:5 says this. Verse 5 of Revelation, the seventh aspect of the book of life. We are also victorious ones. Verse 5 of chapter 3. It says this, he who overcomes shall thus be clothed in white garments, and I will not erase his name from the book of life, but I'll confess it, his name, before my Father and before his angels. You know what? We're victorious. We're more than conquerors. And finally, here's the last one. The very end of the book, Revelation 21:27, it says this, and nothing unclean, this is what I read before, nothing unclean and no one who practices abomination and lying will ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life. Come into where? Come into the glorified heavenly city. So who's in the book of life? Before known ones, blood-bought ones, newborn ones, happy ones, holy ones, joyful ones, victorious ones, and glorified ones because they go to heaven. That's a wonderful thought.